Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Justin Arter from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Christopher Camp, Associate Professor at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Camp was the senior author of the paper titled, "A Number of Modifiable and Non-Modifiable Factors Increase the Risk for Elbow, Medial Ulnar, Collateral Ligament Injury in Baseball Players, a Systematic Review," which is in press in the Arthroscopy Journal. Welcome, Dr. Camp, and thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Thanks, Justin. I really appreciate you having me on today.
Yeah, this is a great topic and certainly an evolving topic. And I feel like something that really is difficult discussion sometimes with adolescent throwers in my practice. So tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this topic and what led you to put this systematic review together.
Yeah. So I'm like you, you know, and I see a lot of patients with elbow related injuries. So it's a very common clinical scenario. And it's been one that we continue to see the injury numbers rise year over year and starting to affect younger and younger players. So I think everybody is starting to see more and more of these patients. So we kind of, and there's quite a bit of literature out there on what increases the risk, but it's sort of all over the place. And some of the studies suggest that certain factors are significant. Other studies say they're not. So we kind of wanted to sort of weed through all of that to get a better feel for what does the evidence show? What are the true risk factors for this? So, and I think that was important, one, to kind of give us an idea of how to better counsel patients, but also to sort of help challenge current dogma to say, what is it that we know to be true and what is it that we know not to be true? And hopefully sort of direct us and guide us on future studies. So those were really all the reasons for us getting started on this project.
Right. I certainly find definitive information and data to tell these parents really is helpful. Tell us a little bit about the results of your studies. I found it interesting regarding pitch counts and velocity and different aspects you looked at. So tell us the most interesting things you found in your study.
You know, I think one of the things that was helpful, at least for me in doing the study, is that it really helped me kind of organize the risk factors. We've all heard of these different things, shoulder range of motion and elbow motion and velocity, pitch, all of those different things. But I didn't have a really, really good system for organizing it all in my mind or on paper or when talking to patients about it. So doing this kind of helped us to see what all the factors were and then kind of group them in like categories to summarize and clean it up. And ultimately, what we found was that it came down to four primary groups or categories of risk factors. Some of those, the first group we call player demographics and characteristics. The second, throwing too hard or high velocity. The third was throwing too much with high throwing volumes. And then the fourth was throwing with poor mechanics. So I think organizing it into those four categories really helps me understand what the risk factors are. And I think it can help us in our approach when we're talking to patients. And it's nice because we know that most of the patient-related demographics and characteristics are things that we can't change. You know, some of them are things like age and height and that sort of stuff. So those are non-modifiable. It's helpful to know, nothing you can do about it. So it's not really good to discuss those in clinic. The next one being throwing too hard or with increased velocity, that's been one of the more clear risk factors. The problem is patients don't really care. If we tell them that increased velocity is going to increase their risk for injury, they would still rather have the performance benefit of the high velocity, and they're willing to accept an injury risk. So even though it's helpful from an educational standpoint, it's not very, I would not consider velocity to be a practically modifiable risk factor because they're going to try to keep chasing velocity the best they can. So that one is of educational benefit, but it's not practically modifiable. I think the other two are the areas where we can really make some strides. So one is increased throwing volume or throwing too much. And then the second is throwing with poor mechanics, or the fourth is throwing with poor mechanics. So in my mind, those two categories are the ones that are the most modifiable and probably going to be the most beneficial for us to use in our any injury prevention or risk mitigation strategies that we try to employ with our patients.
Yeah, that's a really nice summary. Definitely people are not going to say they're going to throw less velocity to protect their elbow. I think here's a good point.
Yeah.
One thing that I saw in your paper was some of the studies cited a more lateral release being a risk factor for UCL injury. Are you talking with that specifically about patients, or how do you address that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it gets tough too. And I think as clinicians, we can find, if we start talking, pitching biomechanics and kinetics and kinematics with players, especially if you've got a pretty sophisticated player, you know, high level college or professional pitcher, we'll very quickly get out of our comfort zone. Because I mean, this is a whole nother world that most clinicians are not prepared to discuss. So I would say a couple things. If you see these patients and you want to have those discussions, do the best you can to be familiar with pitching mechanics and the different things that are modifiable. So that's number one. The second I would tell you is that if you look at other studies that relate to pitching mechanics and how they impact velocity, most of the changes to mechanics that improve velocity actually decrease elbow stress, or they can increase velocity while maintaining the same elbow stress or maybe even lowering it. So I do think that there are mechanical factors that can be optimized that will potentially reduce injury risk while improving velocity. And if we can really figure that out, that's sort of the holy grail. So yes, the release point is definitely one of them. That's one that we found in this study. Since this has been published, there's been some other studies that have come out that looked at trunk tilt and lead knee extension as well that are probably other targets. So they're definitely targets. I think this is the thing we need to be looking at. But I would encourage most clinicians, if you're going to have those conversations, be ready, because that hole can get really deep really quickly. So you want to know what you're getting yourself into. And I would also encourage you to find a way to partner up with somebody else who has some specialized expertise in that, whether that's a physical therapist that you can plug them in and work with, or you get to know that player's coach, performance coach that they're using. Find somebody who can be an ally with you that can kind of help in that regard.
Yeah, that's a great point regarding getting in that deep hole. It's true with dancers and all kinds of different sports maybe we're less familiar with or that are so subspecialized. And one question I wanted to ask you, which you brought up regarding physical therapists and pitching coaches, give us some advice about how to foster those relationships. You know, I've been lucky enough to have a mentor that has really set that up before I got here, but give us some advice about how you found that to be helpful, how keeping in touch with maybe people that aren't right in your town, and how to keep people on the top research like we're discussing here and adjusting different aspects of the throwing mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, Justin. I think too, you know, the physical therapists are just like us. They all sort of have some subspecialty interest, and there is a growing body of physical therapists out there that are interested specifically in the overhead athlete and the thrower. And I think it's critical to figure out who those people are in your town or at your facility or institution. Get to know them, open up the lines of communication. And I think there's a lot of great ways of doing that. If they're in your own institution, that's much easier. For us here at Mayo, after we operate on a patient, when they come back for follow-up, we actually see them in conjunction with the physical therapist. So it's the patient, the physical therapist, and myself, all three of us standing there together, talking about their current status, where they are in their rehab progression or throwing program, what the next steps are. And I learn a lot in those conversations, just hearing from our physical therapist, the way they talk to the patient, the things that they analyze. So as much as you can make yourself available for those consultations and discussions, the better, because you can certainly learn a lot and foster that relationship with the physical therapist. And I think it also breeds a lot of trust for the patient. They see us working together with the physical therapist, so they know that we're all on the same page, which I think can be immensely helpful. If they're outside of your institution, it takes a little bit more work, but I think it's something that can be done. I think it's helpful if you can get out in the community, actually go see their facilities, see what they do, talk to them, communicate via email, text message, phone call, whatever it is. Most of the physical therapists that see our throwing athletes all have, you know, my phone number, and they know to reach out to me, and we're in pretty close communication, which I think is really helpful. And I find ultimately it not only does that help me learn more, helps me get to know them, it ultimately delivers better care to the patient. If we shorten up those lines of communication between all of us, I think it's immensely helpful. And I mean, there's other ways too, you know, going out and giving talks in the community, I think can be really helpful. and getting to know the athletic trainers at your various schools and teams is also immensely helpful. I think the athletic trainers and physical therapists work very well together, and we need to be a part of that group as well. So getting to know those PTs and ATCs locally can be a little more challenging, a little more time consuming, but in the past, I have always found that to be time well spent.
Right. And a lot of these, or most of these shoulder and elbow injuries from throwers, are treated non-operatively, and really the right person can help them avoid surgery. So that's really good advice. You know, to back up a little bit regarding the epidemic of elbow injuries that we've all been seeing, you know, your paper cites in the major leagues, 13 to 25% the risk of UCL injury with an increase in position players on top of the normal, you know, typically pitchers seeing these injuries. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen in your practice and how you've addressed that over the years.
Yeah. I think a few things that we're seeing is certainly the UCL injuries continue to rise year over year. Those increases are most pronounced in younger athletes as well. So at the major league level, we're starting to see that growth or that increase start to flatten out or plateau, which is nice. That's good to see. But the problem is those cases are not going away. They're just shifting to earlier in their careers. So we're seeing more dramatic increases happening in minor league and then even college and then even high school. So what's happening is the primary UCL injury, the primary UCL surgery, they're not going away. They're just getting pushed to earlier in the career. And my concern, what I think is going to happen, is that as we see these earlier surgeries occurring and patients having them at younger and younger ages, we're going to start to see the back end of that. And that for our older athletes, we're probably going to start to see revision numbers increase as they're having surgery earlier and earlier. So those are the big things that we're seeing now. And I just in clinic today, I saw a patient, 12-year-old and a 14-year-old with UCL injuries. Now, they should do very well with non-operative treatment, but it goes to show that these are shifting to younger and younger patients for sure. And that continues to be a major concern.
Right. It's not going to get any easier or less complex, that's for sure. One thing you really outline nicely in your article, some details about year-round play and sports specialization and long toss and breaking balls. And we just were speaking before this about weighted baseballs. Tell us a little bit about addressing those issues with young players and families. I found that very difficult, talking about the multiple teams and advising them on how to protect their elbow or rehab their elbow appropriately.
Yeah, I think there's sort of maybe three things in there that I'll hit on real quickly. So, you know, one is the throwing volume, one will be the weighted balls, and one is the pitch characteristics, which I think is going to be the next problem that's coming up. So for the throwing volume, absolutely. You know, we used to see studies that showed that warmer our states in warmer climates had more UCL injuries. And that is becoming, that's probably still true to some degree, but it's becoming less of an issue because now, even in the northern and colder states, there are facilities that are opening up so athletes can continue to throw year round. And that's happening everywhere. And that volume of throwing is one of the most obvious and clear risk factors for injury. So that is something that really we have to get a good handle on. And now you've got kids playing multiple teams in the same season, in the same week. They're playing multiple games for different teams. And also they're playing multiple positions. You know, that's different than what the high-level college and pro guys do, where they're either a pitcher or a position player. These younger kids, when they're, you know, the star pitcher, they're often the star shortstop as well, or the catcher, or an outfielder. So if they're not pitching, they're playing in the field. So we have to talk to patients about trying to take some time off during the season. When they're not pitching, try to actually take a break, maybe not always play another position. Or if they do want to play another position, maybe pitch a little bit less. So those discussions are tough, and they usually stem from a lack of understanding or education on what those pitch recommendations are. So I do think the Pitch Smart guidelines that have been put together can be super helpful for that. The other question was the weighted balls. And that's a question I'm getting more and more in clinic as well. And I think the problem with the weighted balls is that it's sort of a quick fix for velocity. We know that they can be pretty effective for increasing velocity, but they tend to do so just by generating more speed and force by increasing strength, not necessarily by improving mechanics. So yes, you're adding velocity, but you're doing so in a way that is not mechanically efficient. So that increased velocity comes with increased stress, which is concerning for injury. So those patients I talk to, I say, weighted balls are not necessarily a bad thing, but you need to make sure that your mechanics are tuned up first. So we need to make you an efficient thrower and a safe thrower. Then we can add that increased stress to your elbow. But until you get things cleaned up and you minimize the elbow stress and you distribute things across the entire kinetic chain, weighted balls are probably not a good idea for you. So that's sort of that how I have that conversation. And then lastly, the other thing you mentioned was different pitches. And I think that we do see, different pitch utilization and pitch breakdowns can affect injury. And one of the things that I think is going to be interesting that we're going to see over the next few years is now the ability we have to measure pitch characteristics is unbelievable. And so much more than just velocity. Now we can look at spin rates, spin axis, horizontal break, vertical break. You can look at all these different pitch characteristics, and now we know how those can improve performance as well, not just velocity. So I think what we're seeing at the higher levels, professionally, the professional levels, is players are making changes to their grips and their releases and their arm action, chasing these different values in terms of break and spin rates. And I'm worried that in doing that, that may also contribute to some elbow injury as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over the next couple of years. But I think having pitchers work aggressively at changing pitch characteristics is going to be something that may end up being a problem for us on the injury front.
Yeah, great summary there. I think we're getting more and more data. Like you said, we just have to figure out how to evaluate this and what's really important in your study. Starts us off on that path. So that's really great. One thing I find difficult is getting these parents and players on board. Do you have any tips about, these patients are playing on two teams and, well, my pitch count is this, but they're looking at their two teams separately. Do you have any thoughts about, getting these young kids and parents, you think, especially on board to really protect their arms? I think that's a really tricky conversation to have.
Yeah, it is really difficult, and it's something I continue to struggle with. You know, a few things that I have found to be helpful is, one, letting them know that I'm on the same team. And I tell them, my goal is for your son or daughter or whoever the patient is, my goal is for them to be as good a pitcher or thrower or athlete as possible for as long as possible. Would you agree that that's your goal as well? And usually, they say yes and they shake their head. And I say, okay, this is how I think we can do it. It's not just throwing as hard as you can, as much as you can. We have to be thoughtful and strategic about this. And I think getting them to recognize that I'm on their team, we need to work together as a team for the sake of their child or this adult athlete, whichever one it is, I think sometimes can be helpful, not always. Another one, though, is to give them a little bit of data. And now there's pretty good evidence out there, not just for baseball, but in other sports as well, that multi-sport athletes not only have lower risk of injury, but also can have increased performance at the professional level if they played multiple sports as a child, too. So using some of that information sometimes can be really helpful in letting them know that, no, this is not a sign of weakness when you're taking time off. It can actually make you a better baseball player or softball player or javelin thrower or whatever it is. And sometimes those things can be helpful as well, but even with those, it still can be a very difficult conversation.
Yeah, those are great pearls. Giving a little bit of time to establish that rapport is so important. Talking about these athletes in general with, say, a slap tear or an elbow issue, are there certain things that you typically see? I know Dr. Bradley will talk about people starting to lose velocity, miss high and outside. Are there certain things that you see that these throwers typically start feeling or complaining of that shows their elbow or shoulder or something in their kinetic chain is really breaking down?
Yeah. I think so. And, obviously pain is a big one, and that's usually when they come in to see us, but not always. I do think that there are a few telltale signs that can often tip you off before pain occurs. And this was included even in our study, that actually a drop in velocity leading up to the injury often occurs. So if they're noticing, even if they're not having pain, but the velocity is not what it used to be, that may be a sign that something's going on. Another one I think is that if they develop any acute changes in their motion. So if all of a sudden their shoulder tightens up or their elbow tightens up, they can't fully extend the elbow, or they lose a bunch of internal rotation acutely. And even if it's not painful, I think that's another one that can tip them off. And then a third one that I think is really helpful is that if they're starting to notice that it's taking them longer to recover. So always ask how they feel the day after a start. And some pitchers say, you know, usually I would feel fine the day after a start and I'd go out and do some light toss and I was fine. But now I'm fine. It's taking me 2 or 3 days to fully recover, to get my motion back and be able to play catch and toss. That's another sign, or early warning sign, that something more sinister may be going on. So I think all of those tips can be helpful.
They're very good tips. I know this is a big topic, but can you tell us briefly about how you evaluate the kinetic chain and its importance mm-hmm. in these throwers and how you address some of those things? I know this could be hour and hour conversations about that, but just briefly some tips you have.
Yeah, one of the things I do is I discuss the concept of the kinetic chain with the athlete to try to get them to understand and buy into. And hey, this is not just about your elbow or your shoulder. We got to talk about the whole body. And usually they nod their head in agreement. So I try to get them to make sure they understand that concept first. Then once they do, then I talk about it a little bit. So I'll often check, depending on what the problem is, I may just do a quick exam of their lower extremity and make sure they have full range of motion in their ankles, their knees, and their hips, and check strength. I do like to assess core strength. There's a few ways you can do that with a front plank or a side plank, I think are great options. I also like to look a little bit at balance and dynamic control. So have them stand on one leg and then try to touch their toe with the opposite hand. So if you can have them hold the right leg up in the air, stand on the left leg, and then touch the left toe with their right fingers, I think is a great way to assess balance, proprioception, core strength. So those are just a few of the things that I'll do to try to bring out some potential weakness. Doing a one-legged squat is another thing. Those are quick little things that I'll do in clinic. But ultimately, I think a full assessment is really that's when having that relationship with the physical therapist is going to be immensely helpful. So I'll do kind of a quick eval of that in the clinic. But if I think there's issues, then I'll send them to a trusted physical therapist for sort of a full evaluation and develop a plan to address the entire kinetic chain.
Yeah, those are great tricks. Thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. One thing I know you mentioned before about, this started with GERD, loss of interrotation, and now we know maybe it's more total arc of motion and people are talking about humeral retrotorsion. It can all be a little bit confusing. Can you discuss how you evaluate this shoulder range of motion for people and what you find to be important and clinically how you evaluate this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really difficult. I see. So retrotorsion, I think, is one thing to look at. It's difficult to measure and assess. You know, ideally, you need ultrasound in order to do that. So in clinic, I find that somewhat difficult. Sometimes you can kind of palpate by feeling the bicipital groove and the transcondylar axis on the distal humerus, but I don't fully feel confident in my ability to make accurate measurements on that clinically without an ultrasound or something to actually visualize. So to be honest with you, I think that's difficult to assess. I do think in clinic, looking at standard range of motion measurements can be really helpful. And you're right, the literature's all over the place on what is problematic. But the sort of the quick cheat that I use that I think is pretty clear based on the literature is for internal rotation, I like for them to be within 20 degrees of their opposite side. For external rotation, they should have 5 degrees more ER on the throwing side than the opposite side. And their total arc of motion should be equivalent or greater on the throwing side. So those are sort of the three things that I look for as sort of my quick range of motion guide. And I do think it's important to compare them to the opposite side. If there is concern for humeral retrotorsion, then I think the total arc of motion becomes more important than just the ER or IR. So that's sort of my general gestalt of how I do it in clinic.
Yeah, that's awesome. Appreciate that. So as we wrap up here, again, a big question, but give us your pearls and thoughts about how you address, say, someone that needs UCL surgery. Are you doing repairs? Do you think there's a future mm-hmm. with repair, reconstruction mm-hmm. techniques? There's just so much out there, and it's hard for some of us that are earlier in our careers to really simplify some of these decisions. And then also, can you talk a little bit about your return to play afterwards and what you kind of tell the patients timing wise?
Yeah. It's a great question, Justin. Honestly, I could go for weeks on this, so I'll try to be brief if I can. I do think that repair is very reasonable, particularly for acute injuries that are clearly proximal or distal avulsions. I think that that's reasonable. I think, you know, reconstruction for mid-substance tears, high-grade chronic injuries, I think it is probably more appropriate. What I have been doing recently, actually, which has evolved, is I have found that because repairs have had reasonable success when augmented with a brace or suture tape, it's really got me thinking about how biology is so important to this rather than just biomechanics. If you look at most of our attempts at improving UCL surgery, it's usually by adding biomechanical strength. So we throw in more anchors, more tapes, more sutures, more things to make it stronger. We haven't really made a lot of progress in improving the biology. And I think that that's going to be the next step. That's the thing that we really have to do to promote healing and speed up our timelines for recovery. So I've actually moved in the last several years to doing an anatomic technique, which increases tendon to bone contact, and the thinking that it's more biologically friendly, more likely to heal because you have more tendon to bone contact. I also, with every single UCL case, I do a repair in addition to reconstruction. So historically, we would split the ligament in line with its fibers to identify the joint. Now I actually go through the tear. So if it's a distal tear, I'll elevate it distally. If it's a proximal tear, I'll elevate it proximally, just enough to peak at the joint line. And then I formally repair the native tendon or native ligament back down and then add the reconstruction with internal brace on top of that. And with that, we found improved biomechanics and hopefully improved biology. And our clinical results for that have been encouraging. And we're looking to publish those later this year, which have been very encouraging. So I think the next iteration of UCL surgery is not necessarily going to be just repair versus reconstruction, but how can we optimize the biologic healing, which is probably the thing that will make the largest impact on improving recovery and rehab timelines. So I think that's the interesting thing I think that we're going to see play out over the next few years. And then in terms of rehab, for me, I generally have patients in a brace for the first 6 weeks. During the first 2 weeks, the brace is locked at about 70 degrees of flexion, and we don't do any motion, just let things calm down. From weeks 2 to 4, start getting going on motion with the goal of getting full motion by 6 weeks. Strengthening starts at week 6. Depending on how they're doing, throwing generally starts around 3 months. Even for reconstructions, throwing starts around 3 months, and that's progressed as tolerated. And then once they're out throwing out to 120 or 150 feet on the line, we start a mound progression, which usually begins around 5 months postoperative. And then we progress the mound phase as tolerated. And with position players, often getting them back in games around 6 months. Pitchers, more like 9 to 12, depending on the role, whether they're starter or reliever.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Appreciate that. And it makes a lot of sense because that's been the progression really with rotator cuff repairs too. We've gotten better anchors and tapes, and mm-hmm. now we're searching for the best biology. So it certainly makes a lot of sense. And we'll have to look into some of your techniques and papers. I encourage people to look at that. It's a very thoughtful technique and idea. So I really appreciate your time and sharing our results with us today. Really was a complete and well thought out discussion. So I learned a lot and really appreciate your time, Dr. Kim.
You got it, Justin. Thank you so much for having me on. It's always an honor to have the chance to chat with you.
Yeah, it's exciting a time in this type of procedure and issue with throwers, and it's certainly not getting any easier for the patients or the surgeons. So I'd like to thank you again. And Dr. Kemp's article titled, "A Number of Modifiable and Non-Modifiable Factors Increase the Risk for Elbow Medial Ulnar Collateral Ligament Injury in Baseball Players, a Systematic Review," which is in press in the Arthroscopy Journal and is available online at arthroscopyjournal.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.